Now, when we were taking communion, I mentioned that we participate in Jesus' death. And of course, that's half of the story. We participate in his death and in his resurrection. And that's what I want to talk about today. And in particular, Jesus' own words, "I am the resurrection," which we find in John chapter 11. Fiona, would you please pass me my glasses? I'm going to read you. It's quite a long story. It's 44 verses, the story of the raising of Lazarus. Thank you. I've slightly abridged it, so you may find it a little frustrating to follow along within your Bibles, but you can follow on the screen if you like. Now, a man named Lazarus was sick. When he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. And then he said to his disciples, "Let's go back to Judea. Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to wake him up." On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Now Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha answered, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe me?" "Yes, Lord," she replied. "I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. And Jesus wept. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. So they took away the stone. And then Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." And the dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and cloth around his face. Now, this is a very familiar story for people who've been Christians for a long time. But this is one of those ones where there's always more to be dug out of it. There's such a lot of weight to this, and in particular in Jesus' words. So what can we get from this? Well, the first thing is the observation that death, in the way that Jesus sees it, is not permanent. He tells his disciples, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it's for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." But in fact, Lazarus did die. So was Jesus mistaken? Did he misinterpret what was going to happen? No, unsurprisingly, that's not the answer. He says very clearly, "This sickness will not end in death." What he doesn't say is death won't be part of the process. And in fact, what Jesus saw at that point is that in Lazarus's case, although death would be part of what happens, he will pass through that and into life. And that, as we will see, prefigures what Jesus has for every one of us. So it's for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. And that's why I think Jesus uses the phrase, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, and I'm going there to wake him up." Obviously, when Jesus says "fallen asleep," it's a euphemism. He means that Lazarus has died. But from Jesus' perspective, it is like falling asleep and he will be woken. And this idea of death as a falling asleep is one that runs through the New Testament. We see it in a lot of places. Here's one in Paul's letter to the Thessalonians. "For we believe that Jesus died and rose again, and so we believe that God will bring with Jesus those who have fallen asleep in him." And you can find other places as well. So that's a very long running and consistent theme in the New Testament, that death is seen as a sleep rather than as an end. But that doesn't for a moment mean that death is not a serious thing. And I would hate us to feel as though there's a sort of expectation that we should just shrug it off and say, oh, you know, it's no big deal, we're just going to a better place. I don't think that's how Jesus is at all. And we know that from the fact that he wept, and from the whole tenor of the story that I've summarized, that it was, he felt deeply how wrong this is. And in some translations, you read that he was angry at Lazarus having died, as though there's an outrage at this violation of how things should be, that a loved human that God has made and chosen and loved from the foundation of the world should go through the indignity of death. It is. I mean, what an unexpected point for somebody to make in a sermon, that death is a big thing, right? Who would have thought? Maybe this isn't news to anyone. But there is an idea, isn't there, in some Eastern religions, for example, that death is an illusion and that this world is just like a plane of dreams. I don't believe at all that that's what we're told in the New Testament. I don't think that's what we're expected to believe. It's not how we're supposed to live our lives. This life is real, and the way that it ends is real. I think it's good for us to acknowledge the weight of that. If we ever doubt that death is a serious thing, physical death is a serious thing, we only have to look at the cross and that the anguish that that was for Jesus and how unwilling he was to go through with it. Reading the prayers in Gethsemane, it's really obvious Jesus did not want to do this. Father, if it's possible, take this from me. But not my will, but yours be done. It's a serious thing. And only because Jesus saw further than death was he able to do that and to make the choice to obey what his Father had planned for him. For the joy set before him, it says in Hebrews, he endured the cross, despising its shame. And that's a matter of seeing further. So in Jesus' case, for his own life, he recognized what a horror death is. But he also saw it in perspective, that there is a joy that's set before him that's worth so much more than the pain of the death. So as we feel the weight of the deaths of people that we love, and ultimately as we come to the point where we face our own deaths, as each of us likely will do, I don't think there's any call on us to minimize the weight of that. I don't think there's any biblical idea that we should make it less than it is. But there absolutely is a biblical idea that we look beyond that truth to other and deeper truths. And that really is what I want to major on today. So here is the key section in the passage that I read. When Jesus says to Martha, your brother will rise again. And Martha answered, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. And Jesus corrected her. No, he said, I mean right now. No, that's not what it says. Jesus doesn't correct her. Here's what he says. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Isn't that interesting combination of things to say? So he who believes in me will live even though he dies. Jesus there acknowledging the reality that we will die and that Lazarus has died but will live even though he dies. Then Jesus goes straight on to say something that's almost a contradiction of that. Whoever lives and believes in me will never die. And obviously what he's saying there isn't we'll never pass through death but will never ultimately be dead. That person who believes in me will never be extinguished. There will always be life for that person. Now, I find myself wondering as well, when Jesus said these critical words, I am the resurrection and the life, I wonder how he said that. So we tend to imagine him talking with Martha and then almost like in a Hollywood movie, standing up and spreading his arms and pronouncing, I am the resurrection and the life. Maybe it was like that. Maybe that was like a big moment. But I wonder as well whether maybe it was much more gentle and intimate thing. And maybe he was just explaining to Martha in her grief. Maybe it was just him sitting with that one woman and explaining, yeah, Lazarus will rise again. Do you know why? It's because I'm here and I am the resurrection. I am the life. And I wonder whether this incredible, profound theological insight, I'm the resurrection and the life, that has so much resonance. I wonder whether Jesus just gave that to one grieving woman in a quiet, private moment. And maybe she told the disciples about that later, and that's how it got into the gospel. We can't tell. You know, the gospel account, all the stories in the gospels, really, they just skip across the facts quite quickly. They don't go into a lot of motivation or character like a novel would. So we don't know how these words were said. But I just wonder whether that's what it was like. Just a gentle explanation. So what does it mean then for Jesus to be the resurrection? Well, resurrection, we understand that to be the restoration of life. But you've got to say, well then, okay, where did the life come from in the first place that's being restored? And the answer, I think, is the same place as all life on Earth and whatever life there might be on other planets. You never know. I'm excited about the possibility. And the very existence of the physical universe that life exists in, it all, again, comes back to Jesus himself. Here is what Paul writes in a letter to the Colossians. Christ is the visible image of the invisible God. He existed before anything was created and is supreme over all creation. Why supreme over it? Listen, because through him God created everything in the heavenly realms and on earth. He made the things we can see and the things we can't see, such as thrones and kingdoms and rulers and authorities in the unseen world. So among the many, many things that Jesus is he's the author of the physical universe and of organic, biological life. And of the, you know, right down to the scientific level of the cells in your body metabolizing and the mitochondria doing their thing and all the rest of that. All of that comes under the authorship of Jesus. So he is the author of biological life. And of course, beyond that, beyond biological life is the spiritual life. So in Acts, I love this little segment from when Peter stands up and preaches spontaneously in chapter 2 of Acts. He says, God raised Jesus from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death, because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him. Why? Because he's the author of life. Jesus is life. I am the resurrection and the life. So death cannot hold him. And by the way, I love the middle section of a song we sometimes sing, death could not hold you. How does it go? The grave. Pardon? That's the second half of that middle section. Yeah. Death could not hold you. The grave couldn't hold you. You silence the boast of sin and grave. And we'll sing that at the end, by the way. So, and that arises from the fact that Jesus is life, the resurrection and the life. It's in his nature, if you like. You could almost say that I don't believe resurrecting Lazarus was, in some sense, a big deal for Jesus, because Jesus is life, and that the life kind of flows off him. I like the idea of, you can look at all the miracles that Jesus does in the New Testament and see all of them as a kind of overflow of his life. I imagine Jesus kind of bursting with life, and almost you could imagine a sort of way to perceive the imagery is like life flowing from him into the woman who touched the edge of his cloak and was healed from her decades of bleeding, or like Jairus' daughter raised to life when Jesus was with her. Just the life in Jesus flowing out of him, or would be better to say overflowing from him. And that applies to all miracles, but especially to these miracles of resurrection. And we see it in action in the case of Lazarus here. So I suppose my point here is that the resurrection of Lazarus, it wasn't a one-off. It's kind of the best and most detailed story in the Gospels of Jesus raising someone to life. But it happens several other times. And more than that, every time Jesus brings a dead person to life in the New Testament, what that's doing is giving us a kind of a pre-echo, if you like, of the true resurrection. Well, two true resurrections, actually. So firstly, of course, the resurrection of Jesus himself. And I find it interesting that the story of Lazarus is the last miracle you read about in John's Gospel before it goes straight from that into the next miraculous event is Jesus' own resurrection. Now, in the first case, Jesus is standing outside of the dead person. Life is overflowing from Jesus into Lazarus, and then Lazarus is raised from the dead. But in the case of Jesus' own resurrection, when his body is the one that's dead, it's just too alive to be dead. You can almost imagine kind of the life welling up inside him and just refusing and saying, no, death can't hold me. Of course not. And the other great resurrection, when I said there are two great resurrections to come, of course, is the resurrection of all of us, which Martha brilliantly has the insight to recognize when she's talking to Jesus and says, yes, I know Lazarus will rise on the last day. She's absolutely right. And this, again, is a promise that runs through the New Testament. And the reason why this story is of relevance to each of us is because each of us is promised a resurrection. A foretaste of our resurrection is seen in Lazarus being raised to life. And again, you can look through the New Testament, see this over and over again in different places. Here is just one of them. First chapter of Paul's letter to the Ephesians. God's incomparably great power for us who believe is the same as the mighty strength he exerted when he raised Christ from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly realms. In other words, that same power that raised Christ to life, that same overflowing joy of life is at work in us and will bring us life as well. And here in the famous resurrection chapter in First Letters of the Corinthians, Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For since death came through a man, the resurrection of the dead also comes through a man. For as in Adam all die, so in Christ all will be made alive. Now this idea of first fruits is, we don't really have it in modern society, I guess, but it's literally the first thing you get from the harvest, whether it's actual fruit or grain or whatever else, the first that you get in. And often that would be used in a sacrifice in Old Testament times. But the point of it here, what it's symbolizing is that the first fruits are the promise of all the rest of the fruit that's to come. So when you get to whenever the first apple is ripe on your tree, you pick the apple, you eat the apple, that's great. But actually what's going on is not just that one apple, but the promise of all the other apples that you're going to get from the same tree in that season, because it's the first fruit that guarantees what's to come. And in the same way, the resurrection of Christ himself is described here as being the first fruit of those who have fallen asleep. That'll be all of us. Now, each of us will fall asleep. And of course, this feels particularly relevant because we all know at the moment, it seems, people who are in serious illnesses and we don't know how long they've got on this earth. They will fall asleep. If not soon, then later. And, it, you know, 70, 80, 90 years will account for all of us. Right? But Jesus, in his resurrection, is the first fruits of all of us who fall asleep. And just as he, by the power of the life that was in him, was raised to life, so we, by the power of the life that is in him, will also be raised to life. So I want to look at exactly what that means then. So what is resurrection? Because, you know, if you just read John chapter 11 and 12, what happens is Lazarus walks out the grave, they clean him up, and then he just pops up a couple of times in the next chapter, having dinner with Mary and Martha, and just basically going back to his life. And the Pharisees plot to kill him because they don't want people to know that Jesus returned him to life. as far as we know, they go ahead with that, so it's not mentioned again. But is that it then? So does it just mean that Lazarus, who was maybe 20 or 30, had died, was raised to life and lived to a ripe, healthy age and had another 50 years, and then eventually as an old man laid down and died, and then, what, 50 years? What's that? It's not enough, is it? So that is not what we are promised, and I think this is so important. C.S. Lewis memorably described it as a totally new mode of being. And it's in this essay called What Are We to Make of Jesus Christ? And I'll briefly read to you from it. He says this: the earliest Christian writers regarded the resurrection as something totally different and new. The resurrection narratives are not a picture of survival after death. They record how a totally new mode of being has arisen in the universe. Something new had appeared in the universe, as new as the first coming of organic life. This man, after death, does not get divided into ghost and corpse. A new mode of being has arisen. And I think that's so important that we understand that the resurrection that awaits us, just like the resurrection that Jesus underwent, is not just going back to the life that we had before and having more of that. It's something so much more than that. Paul writes in that same 1 Corinthians chapter I quoted earlier, our bodies are buried in brokenness, but they will be raised in glory. They are buried in weakness, but they will be raised in strength. They're buried as natural human bodies, but they are raised as spiritual bodies. What's a spiritual body? We think of spirit and body as two completely different things. So this is just a hint, I think, of one of the numerous mysteries that I'm not going to have a good answer to that question, by the way. But there is such a thing, somehow, as a spiritual body. We don't know what it is. We don't know how it'll work. But that's part of the promise for us, that what awaits us after our resurrection is so much more and so much better than what we have now. And you just get a tiny preview of that, if you like, a hint of what it's like in Jesus himself after his resurrection. You could almost say that those 6 or 7 weeks that Jesus was alive on earth after his resurrection, that they were almost kind of unfulfilled. His resurrection was incomplete until his ascension. Because what we were just seeing then was kind of how a resurrected body operates on this physical earth. And we see that there's something different about Jesus after his resurrection. He just appears mysteriously in crowded rooms with no that there's no coming in, and suddenly turns up on the road to Emmaus and then is suddenly gone again. And there's, so, you know, I don't want to just kind of boil this down to something very mundane and say that the spiritual body can teleport. You know, it's nothing as straightforward as that. But there's just hints, I think, in those post-resurrection stories of Jesus, of something about how the body that he has after then is different. And of course, this is the problem. We can't wrap our heads around any of this. You know, we know that God has prepared something extraordinary for us. We know that it doesn't fit into our minds. And that's why I think when you read Revelation, and it's such a confusing book, and I think it's because John himself, as he was seeing the visions that God showed him, he didn't know what they meant. And I kind of imagine him just seeing one thing after another and desperately trying to scribble them down and get his head around, oh no, what did I see again? So there's this description of the holy city coming down out of heaven from God, and it's 1,500 miles long and wide and high. So you get pictures of this one I found is a sort of a cube city, and it's obviously the point isn't that when we die we live in a city that's a gigantic cube, right? It's some attempt on John's part to kind of get what was in his mind out onto paper, and even what was in his mind was only a pale and insipid reflection of the reality. By the way, I got this image from the silliest article I read, from a guy who was saying, oh well, actually, if the heavenly city is a cube, then the light of the lamb can't fill it because the floors will be in the way and people who are further down won't be able to see the light, so it must be a pyramid shape instead with the lamb at the top. And I found myself thinking, how can you so completely miss the point? Right, we are not headed for a giant cube. We are headed for something that simply does not fit in the human imagination. Why? Because we're finite, three-dimensional creatures moving through time at a constant rate of 1 second per second. We will be so much more than that. And it's hardly surprising that the things that we will see, and indeed the things we will be, are not comprehensible to us now. So rightly, Paul writes, no eye has seen and no ear has heard, and no mind has ever conceived the glorious things that God has prepared for those who believe in him. And he goes on to say, but God has revealed it to us by his Spirit. And I think we have a hint, we have a glimpse, as he says elsewhere, like we see it like a bad reflection in a mirror. But that's the best we're going to get for the moment. The one thing we can really know about the resurrected life is that it so exceeds what we know now that it's just beyond description. So I feel like a lot of people are desperately unambitious when they think about what life is and what it can be. I think about prosperity preachers, you know, that terrible heresy that the point of the gospel is to get us good things in this life. And I just imagine what it would be like to have such a poverty of Christian imagination that you think the purpose of Christianity is to get you private jets. No, we look beyond that. We look for something much, much better. And then I think about futurists who I see a lot turning up on the web now and writing about how they're going to have their minds encoded into an artificial intelligence and live on in a computer or basically as a brain in a jar. I think what a weak, weak ambition that is. Is that really the best you can think of for what you want for yourself? And I think about spiritualists and, you know, the idea that you can communicate with the dead and hear these vague messages that, Auntie Mabel says everything is fine on the other side and I hope the cat's being fed. Really, how weak, how very little to hope for. Or even I think about Eastern religions and the idea of reincarnation and the idea that after you live this life, you're reborn as a baby and you live another life and you go on round and round that forever. Again, what a lack of ambition. We are promised and we are headed for something so very, very much greater than any of that. It's not just more of the same, like a reincarnation would be. So here's what I think it's like, that all these people I'm talking about, the prosperity preachers and the brain in jar people and all the rest, they're all saying things like, okay, well, I'm a caterpillar and I'm going to be the biggest, richest, best off caterpillar that there is. That's for the prosperity guys. And others are saying things like, well, do you know, I think there must be a way to contact caterpillars who have died. And other people are saying, well, after I die, when I've stopped being a caterpillar, I think I'm going to be reborn as an egg and be a caterpillar all over again. But of course, that is not the point of a caterpillar. The caterpillar is there to be a butterfly, to become a butterfly. And what awaits us is, again, do you know, like all examples, this is a weak and a flawed example. It only nudges up to some aspects of the truth. But it's closer than any of those things are, because we are not called to be the best possible caterpillars, ultimately. We are called to be butterflies. We will go through a metamorphosis far more profound than caterpillars or butterfly. What we will be, it says elsewhere, we don't even know. I think it's one of John's letters, I think, how great the love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called the sons of God, sons and daughters of God, we could say. And that is what we are. What we will be, we don't even know. And that's true. We're like caterpillars trying to imagine what it's like being a butterfly, except it's so much more than that. So, and sometimes I think we can look at what's waiting for us and so misunderstand it that we almost don't want it. So I think people have an impression of heaven as being very ethereal and vague, and you know, all the Renaissance art of people floating around on clouds and playing harps, and we think, well, that sounds boring. That's because we don't understand what a butterfly is. So, that's what resurrection is. It's being raised from this life, not just to more of this life, but to a much greater life. And that's the promise that each of us has. And the reason that we're made for something greater than this is because we were made by someone greater. The life that awaits us is the life of Christ. Now, already you could say that we're alive because of Christ's act in creation. That, as we said in Colossians, that by him and through him all things were made. But it's also true, and so much more significantly true, that the full, the spiritual life, the resurrection body, the spiritual body, is all from him, from his life. We were made by someone far greater than us, to a far higher end than we can imagine. And the final point I want to make is this, that what we see with almost all the miracles in the Gospels, probably all of them, is they all sort of show us something happening immediately that happens all the time in normal life. So for example, classic example, when Jesus turns water into wine, he does that in a moment. But in fact, where does wine come from? Well, water turns into it. So rain falls on the ground, it's drawn up by the grapevines that grows grapes, and the grapes ferment. It's a natural process. And by the way, all natural processes are God's natural processes. So over a long period of time, water turns to wine. And what Jesus does in that moment is he does it in that moment. So that's what's going on with a lot of the miracles. And you could say as well, like feeding the 5,000, well, he begins with bread, and bread is made of grain, and over time, grain becomes more grain. So that's a natural process, hugely accelerated and brought into a single miraculous moment. So most of the miracles are showing us, if you like, distilled examples of God's goodness to us more generally. So you can think of it as common grace. It's the grace of God that grain becomes more grain and that water becomes wine. And Jesus demonstrates those things in that moment. Here's where the resurrection is different, because instead of just pointing to natural processes and how things go, the resurrection is a miracle that points to the future. It shows us what God will do in us. You could almost say that because the other miracles show us things that we already understand about the natural world, and we can trust those miracles to be a reflection of what happens in the natural world, so we can also trust this great miracle of the resurrection to be an accurate representation of what is coming to us in the spiritual world. So the resurrection of Lazarus points to the resurrection of Christ. The resurrection of Christ points to the resurrection of every single one of us and to the glorious future that awaits us. And the very last thing I want to say, and I realize I just said that the last thing was going to be the last thing I said, but it wasn't. It was the penultimate thing. This genuinely is the last thing. I'm not a resurrectionist. I'm a Christian. So the point here is Jesus is the resurrection. So he says, for example, look at the other I ams in John's gospel. When he says, I am the bread of life, he doesn't say, I will give you the bread of life, as though Jesus is a route to get the thing that you need, the bread of life. And he doesn't say, I will show you the light of the world, or I will shine the light of the world on you. He says, I am the light of the world. And you could go through with all the other I ams and do the same thing and realize that in each case, he's not just saying, here's a good thing and I'm going to bring it to you. He's saying, I am that good thing. And that applies just as much with this one. Jesus isn't saying, I can give you resurrection. I can give you life. He's not saying, I'm the means to resurrection. He's saying something far more profound. I am the resurrection. So in the end, you know, I love that the resurrection awaits us all. But it's not our goal. Jesus himself is our goal. Right? He's the bread of life. But we're not so bothered about bread. Here's the resurrection. We're not so bothered about resurrection. We're bothered about Jesus himself. Because he is greater than any of these things. You know, you could say, how can you care more about Jesus than the resurrection when Jesus says, I am the resurrection? Well, he is the resurrection, but that's not all he is. He's also the bread of life. He's also the good shepherd. He's also the door. And so on. And so very much more. Jesus is greater than any of these things. And the resurrection that awaits us, as extraordinary and incredible as it is just one tiny facet of the full glory of the Jesus that we worship and whose privilege we have of knowing him. So that's where I end. Really, I end with Jesus Christ, who is the resurrection and the life. I don't end with the resurrection. I don't end with the life. I end with Jesus. Because he, in the end, is the substance, he is the foundation, he is the beginning, he is the end. and he's been our lover from before the foundation of the world.